Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. I'm guessing you don't know the answer to this question. What is the oldest art museum in the South? The Telfair Academy of Arts and Sciences happens to be the correct response. Not only is it the oldest, it was founded by a woman. Actually, Telfair Museums, located in Savannah, Georgia's beautiful historic district, also includes the Owens Thomas House and the Jepson Center, a new contemporary building which houses more than 6,000 objects of fine and decorative art, linking Telfair's past with its future. My guest today is Lisa Grove, director and CEO of Telfair Museums. She is responsible for providing the leadership, vision, and guidance to create and stage exhibitions, programs, and events, making Telfair a dynamic center that serves more than 180,000 people a year. Lisa joined Telfair in 2012 after having spent 7 years as deputy director of the Contemporary Art Museum in St. Louis, Missouri, where she oversaw the successful completion of the $10.4 million Contemporary Challenge campaign. In 2012, she received a 40 Under 40 award from the St. Louis Business Journal. Her professional career also includes her work as a traveling exhibitions project manager and educational workshop coordinator at the Smithsonian. On the academic front, Lisa was awarded a prestigious British Marshall Scholarship for graduate study at the University of London. Her degrees include an MA in Art History, an MBA in Strategic Management, and a BA in American Studies. Phew, Lisa, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, of course. Wonderful. Thank you for inviting me to be here with you today.
So let's start this way, Lisa. How, when, and why did your relationship with art begin?
I first remember thinking about myself as an artist when I was a kid, actually. I was always a kid who loved to draw, as, you know, many children do. But when I was in, I think, about first grade, I drew a picture of a horse for a contest. I grew up in Kansas City, and there was a contest for the American Royal Horse Show. And I drew a picture of a horse, and I won a blue ribbon for that and got to ride on a float in the American Royal Parade. And I remember that being the first time that I thought, you know, I'm an artist, and this feels pretty great. And so, you know, that sparked a love throughout life. I always loved to draw. I was fortunate that my high school art teacher was incredibly passionate about what she did and really took myself and other kids under her wing to, you know, take us out to draw and paint out in our community, out and about, outside the school walls. And she really sparked a joy and an interest that's continued on into my career today.
But you, I'm guessing, put down the brush to take on a different role.
Yeah, I think there was a point when I was thinking about, you know, going to college and thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. I knew that I loved art and that I always wanted to be around art. But there were a lot of other things that I liked as well and other strengths that I had. And so I thought if I could find a career where I could be around art and use these other skills to, you know, promote the work of other much more talented artists than myself, that would be a great pursuit in life. And so, you know, what I get to do is work with great artists every day, and yet I can use my skills in, you know, business and organization and those sorts of things to ensure that their work gets out there and seen by many, many more people.
But I mentioned in my introduction that your undergraduate degree was in American Studies. So explain that to me.
Well, I think it came about because I was someone who was a little undecided, and I like to study a lot of different things. I went to Stanford undergraduate, and the American Studies degree is what's called an interdisciplinary degree, and we know where you can take some classes in the history department, some classes in political science, some classes in the law school, you know, about First Amendment law. You can take classes in art history, and I really enjoyed that breadth of experience. And then when it came time to declare a major, American Studies seemed to be the one that really enabled me to, you know, kind of put all those pieces together into a degree. It's an unusual sort of degree because it really is interdisciplinary, but I guess that reflects the way I think in that, you know, I approach the things that I do from lots of different angles, and I really enjoyed that ability to work in a lot of different departments and with a lot of different types of disciplines.
And how did you wind up across the pond?
the scholarship program that I went to England on is called the Marshall Scholarship. And it is a really, really wonderful program that is named in honor of the Marshall Plan as a way of Britain thanking America for the Marshall Plan. It's a scholarship that's funded by the British government. And each year, it's a very competitive program. They select up to 40 American students to go spend 2 years of graduate study anywhere in the United Kingdom. And that, to me, was an incredible opportunity to go live overseas. I'd never done that before. And also gave me an opportunity to focus more specifically in art history, because the program that I went there, I studied at the Courtauld Institute of Art, which is sort of the art history program at the University of London. So it was an incredible opportunity. I was, you know, one of 40 Americans who, you know, we got to go over on the QE2, which was great fun. They don't always do that. The Marshall Scholarship Program, you know, celebrated its 60th year recently, but at the early days, they would go over on the Queen Mary, and then, you know, they started going over on airplanes. But I happened to be the 40th anniversary class, and so to celebrate, they sent us over on the
QE2. Lucky you. So you come back home and maybe things get a little clearer for you that you're going to start to point yourself in the direction of museums?
Yes and no. I actually took a little bit of a diversion before really settling on museums. I think in my mind, I always had this idea that I wanted to do something a little bit differently in the art world or the museum world, in that I didn't go the route of a PhD, which is the route that a lot of people who pursue careers in museums go through. You know, they get a master's in art history, then a PhD, work as a curator, and then ultimately become a director. And I guess when I was an intern at the Smithsonian originally, I had some great mentors who said to me, you know, the future of museums is going to be thinking about them much more like businesses. And so they encouraged me to think about getting business skills to complement the art history. So while I was in England, I did an MBA degree there, which was something I never thought was in the plan, but I thought, well, let me give this a try. It's a great opportunity to learn some new skills. And then coming out of that, I actually spent 7 years living and working in Boston as a strategy consultant, not at all involved with museums, really almost an extended opportunity to learn about business by working with Fortune 100 companies and organizations, helping them understand how to think about their strategic challenges. But it was towards the tail end of those 7 years that I was there that I began bringing things together, the right brain and the left brain side of my interests, I guess, in that I started working with clients that were in the nonprofit industry. So I worked with a performing arts organization as a consultant, helping them think about their own business model. And so I guess that was when I began bringing the art management career more into focus. But my first real opportunity to actually put it into practice myself was when we moved to St. Louis. You know, I mentioned I was from Kansas City. My husband's from St. Louis. So we, after our second child was born, we decided to move a little closer to family to St. Louis. And it just so happened that this brand new contemporary art museum was just opening. And so they were.
Oh, so all the stars were aligned, huh?
The stars were aligned, exactly. Exactly. They were looking for somebody to sort of oversee the business side of the museum. And it was meant to be. It was just a great way for me to really bring that all together. You know, it's like when you look back on your life, sometimes it all seems like it all totally made sense. But at the time, you know, you don't always see necessarily the natural progression. But clearly the pieces were falling into place.
But not for nothing, Lisa. You moved to St. Louis and you get a job as the deputy director. Come on. Did that surprise you or did that make perfect sense to you?
Well, the job was actually advertised as the director of finance and operations. And the way it worked, that when we moved there, I took a year off. My second child had just been born, so I stayed home for a year. And so it was coming up on a year and I thought, okay, it's about time for me to, you know, throw my hat back in the ring here and look for work. And, you know, I happened to see that they were advertising, this new museum was advertising for a director of finance and operations. And I thought, I could do that. Mm-hmm. So I applied and met the director, whose name is Paul Ha, who became an incredible partner and mentor to me. And so I was there for 3 months or less before he said, okay, I'm going to make you deputy director. And
oh,
it just
kind of...
It was really a match made in heaven for us because he was someone who had worked for years in galleries in New York and really knew contemporary artists and had those deep relationships. And he was looking for somebody to help him, you know, build this museum with sort of the organizational skills. And so we really had a great, great match of skills. And so, you know, it just felt natural from the very beginning. So, you know, again, that was really fortunate that it happened to be the right position that came along at the right time with the right personalities.
So after spending 7 years there, were you ready to go? How did that match work with you and Telfair?
Sure. Well, after 7 years as deputy director, I began to think about what next. You know, was I felt that I was ready to step into a director role. But, you know, this career path is a strange one because, you know, in most cities, there's one, maybe two museum director jobs. You know, it's a field that, you know, a museum director position, it happens to open up in a city when one director moves to another museum. And so the positions open up sort of rarely, and you never can really predict where they're going to be. But after, you know, we were getting close to 7 years, I began thinking, well, maybe I should start looking at what's out there and paying attention to opportunities as they come available. And I'd watch, and there would be some director positions that would open in cities where we thought, that's not really where we want to move, you know, not really where we want to be as a family. But when this opportunity came about in Savannah, my husband and I talked, and we thought, well, maybe that would be interesting. Neither of us are from the South. We'd never been to Savannah before. But it has a lot going for it. After really looking at it, it's a wonderful city. It's right on, you know, the coast. It's beautiful and it's historic. And I think there are a lot of interesting things going on here that make it a much more forward-looking city than maybe other cities of its size in the South. So, you know, it just kind of happened that a search firm called me up and invited me to come down, and it really made a lot of sense.
Before we get into the specifics of Telfair, I want to just ask you about gender. Was that ever an issue for you in terms of being female and taking the helm at a museum?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and one that the overall art museum director field is looking at very closely. I'm a member of this group called the Association of Art Museum Directors, and it's a professional organization of about 200 people like myself who head art museums around the country. And about a year ago, we did a whole gender study based on compensation and, you know, and gender in the field. Certainly, more and more women are becoming museum directors. So the field is now, I don't know if it's at 50%, but it's certainly getting close to being equal in terms of the number of women directors. But what you also find is that the women tend to be directors of the smaller institutions.
Sure. Yeah.
Very few women have made it through the top 20 that you would say. So there's still certainly issues associated with that, with gender. And, you know, some of the issues are the way people hire for them is there are these search committees, you know, usually comprised of major donors and trustees who tend to be older and men. And so there may be, you know, implicit bias in terms of thinking about what a museum director should look like or should be like. So, you know, things are changing, but there is still very much a feeling that we've got a long way to go before women are really considered for those top positions. I didn't feel any direct issues for me personally in these positions I've had either in St. Louis or here at the Telfair. Telfair had not my immediate predecessor was a man, but before that, the director was a woman. So there had been precedent in terms of having a woman be a director. But I need to say, honestly, I do face daily issues of, I don't know if it's quite at the level of sexual harassment, but certainly comments and things from patrons that I often say, they wouldn't say that to me if I were a man. You know, So... I think it's like any woman, you know, you get commented on what you wear, you get comments about all kinds
more
of things like
change,
that.
The more they stay the same sort of.
Exactly. But, you know, I don't think it's unique, you know, to this role, or I think it's just anytime there's a woman in a very visible role and a very public role that, you know, sometimes people don't quite know how to interact with someone, you know, it takes time for those things to change.
I interviewed the director of the National Museum of Women in the Arts, which I didn't even know existed. It was a wonderful interview, a terrific woman. And my jaw dropped when she threw this statistic out, that the percentage of women artists who are exhibited in museums is a whopping 6%. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
And again, and not for nothing, you're running a museum that was founded by a woman. And I want to move over to Savannah now and talk about Tell Fair. That is so unique in that it combines the Academy with the Owens Thomas House, with the Contemporary, the Jepson Center. So what's it like to be at the helm of such a cultural trinity?
Well, I think it's that combination of old and new, historic and hip, if you will, that attracted me to the Tell Fair in the first place. And actually, it's a lot of what makes it really vibrant and interesting as an institution today. We talk about the fact that we oversee three centuries of art, history, and architecture. And you really can, by moving between our three buildings, get a sense of, you know, of that span of time and, you know, both historic objects, art objects, and the stories of the people behind them across three centuries. And that's pretty interesting and pretty unique. And the ability to do programming that takes historic artifacts and then connects them with our lives today, I think that's a really interesting one. And it's one that I've been trying to explore a lot more in the last year or two. As an example, the Owens Thomas House, one of our three properties, is a historic house. It's coming up on its 200th year anniversary. So it's this incredible old house that's for years been known as the best historic house in Savannah and known for things of having had indoor plumbing before the White House, you know, things like that.
Oh my gosh.
That people come from. Really pretty interesting, yeah. But what it also has, which had not really ever been talked about until, you know, we've been doing it over the last few years, is behind the main house with all these beautiful rooms is one of the very rare urban slave quarters that remain intact in America today.
Wow.
And it's incredible. It's, you know, this space that's pretty simple and, you know, pretty raw, really, but it tells so much more about the story of the house when you include it into the overall story than if you only look at the main house. And so what we started doing is incorporating the slave quarters into our tours. We started the tours there, and we talk about the people, the enslaved servants who would have lived and worked there. And then we walk over to the main house, but instead of going into the main rooms, we start by going down into the basement and see the space where the slaves would have cooked or, you know, done the laundry or polished the silver. So then when we go upstairs into the fancy dining room and you see all of the luxurious, you know, china and silver on the table, you get a much better sense of the overall way that this house worked, and it really is a microcosm of American history. So we've been getting national recognition for this work we're doing. We call it our reinterpretation project because we're really reinterpreting this house and talking about it as this place of American history. Mm-hmm. But what, getting to your question about the three sites, what I've been doing recently that I think is interesting is trying to connect that now with the contemporary art program we're doing in the modern Jepson Center. And you wouldn't normally think there's a connection, but I thought, you know, what's unique about our place is that I think we're probably the only contemporary art museum in America that also has a original slave quarters as part of its portfolio.
Yeah.
Right? And so let's really use that. And so one of the things we've been doing is doing projects with African-American artists, contemporary artists who are working today, whose work really draws on themes of, you know, slavery and race in America and at the ongoing legacy in our world today. And so we can make a really interesting and I think very relevant link between today, contemporary issues, and go back and connect it to that site of, you know, the slave quarters and the stories there. That's where I felt it was absolutely critical that our exhibitions program and our collection better reflect that aspect of our community. So we've been working to increase the number of African-American artists that we show, artists that we collect in our, you know, in our collection. We just opened an exhibition of work by Nick Cave, which is really exciting and wonderful. He's a great artist who's based in Chicago. But I think it is important that when people in a community, for them to feel that this museum is a place for them, they have to be able to see that the works on the walls represent them.
I think I'm still so stunned by the fact that last year I was saying it was 2016, now it's 2017, and we're making strides, but I can't believe we have to make strides.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes it's hard to know how we all can make a difference. And so I try to think, well, what can I do given the platform that I have in a museum to help further this conversation today? And, you know, it's by addressing these issues of the past, making sure that we are having work out there that is more inclusive and more diverse, making sure we're putting things out there that make people talk and make people think about issues that matter. That's something that I feel really passionately about, that museums can be these spaces that really can prompt dialogue. They can prompt people to maybe talk more openly than they otherwise would about issues. You know, something like this Nick Cave exhibition that we have on view. So his work is, he calls them sound suits, and they're essentially these large sculptural pieces that he makes that kind of fit on his body. He was trained as an Alvin Ailey dancer, and so they're these big, really fantastical forms made of the shape of his body. But what he talks about when he made them originally, when he started, was in 1992, and he made it in response to the Rodney King riot.
Uh-huh.
And that was 25 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was the sense that he felt very vulnerable as a Black man in America. And so he kind of picked up twigs and things and made the suit to cover his body that almost was like a suit of armor, you know,
wow.
A sense of protection and mm-hmm. vulnerability. But what it also did, and where this was really, really interesting, we had school kids come in all the time at the museum, and, you know, you get to go in and hear them talk about the work. And they were looking at Nick Cave's work, and they talked about the fact that if you think about it, he created these things to hide his body, that it meant that, you know, when you look at it, you can't tell if it's a boy or a girl or the color of his skin. Everybody is sort of equal when they're wearing these sound suits that he calls them. And the kids just had the most interesting, insightful conversation about that, talking about why today would we need to hide our identity? Why would we need to create
wow.
a suit of armor to protect us from the world? And, you know, that it was a goosebumps kind of moment when you see how art and art museums really can make a difference and really can push the dialogue further. And, you know, you hope those kids went home and maybe over dinner the parents said, "What'd you do today?" And they said, "I visited the museum." And, you know, maybe you sparked a little bit of a conversation. So I think we all have a part to play, you know, in making sure that those issues that matter to us are shared with as many people as possible.
Oh, I think your role is critical. I'm wondering what you think Mary Telfair would say. Talk just a little bit about her. Who was she?
Sure. She's a really interesting historical figure. And so Mary Telfair was the last surviving member of the Telfair family, which was a very prominent family here in Georgia. Her father was a governor of Georgia. Her brothers were all, you know, in governmental roles and things. But they all died before her, and she never married and never had children. And actually, we think that a big part of that is because she really was a woman ahead of her time, and she realized that at the time, had she married, she would have had much less independence, much less financial independence, as well as, you know, personal independence.
Wow.
And so she really was very cultured. She traveled to New York frequently. She traveled to Europe frequently. So she was educated and very forward-thinking. And so when she died with no heirs, she left her home and some stock to Savannah with the provision in her will that said she wanted it to become the Telfair Academy of Arts and Sciences, which was a very fancy 19th century word for a museum. you know, the academy was sort of, you know, this idea then, because it also included drawing classes and things like that. But she did it because she really felt that she wanted to bring culture to her hometown of Savannah. And it was founded as a public art museum from the very beginning. Now, what that meant in 1875 when she died, of course, was very different than what we would think today. It was, you know, not accessible to everyone. Certainly the African-American population was not initially part of what was considered as part of the public for the institution, but it was founded with this idea that it was for the people, for her community of Savannah. And so it from the very beginning had a very civic role in mind and also a very educational role in mind. The first director went to Europe and commissioned all kinds of reproductions of famous sculptures from Greek and Roman history, got these sculptures from the Vatican, made copies and reproductions of them, brought them over, and shared them here in Savannah. We still have a number of those in our collection. And the idea was to really make sure that the people of Savannah had access to these great works of Western culture. So even though I'm sure she could not imagine what we're doing today, and you know, and our definition of the community we serve is much broader and more inclusive than what hers would have been, I think she'd be proud, because I think that we are continuing to serve that core part of her mission, which was enhancing the cultural life of Savannah and making sure that we're elevating the community's access to great works of art.
Her name and yours should be said in the same breath, in the sense that what you're taking the helm of is so different and so unique. These three separate entities that you brought together, that just doesn't happen on any kind of a regular basis. Does that overwhelm you?
Well, I don't know any differently here. We have a lot going on. Having three museums in one adds some complexity, certainly to the just, you know, day-to-day operations of it. But we've got a great team in place, and the people who work for the museum care passionately for what we do, and you know, we love to share it. Savannah has a great and growing tourism industry. We have lots of visitors from all around the world who come to Savannah to see its beauty and to learn about the history. And so I think that's motivating, and I think we're our real advantage is because we have three very different things to share. We can, you know, appeal to you know, three times as many people.
Because the Jepson Center in and of itself is so, I mean, it's a modern museum. That's the building that I visited. It's modern and all these massive windows. You know, the contrast is stunning between the contemporary and the historic.
There's nothing like it in Savannah, you know, and it really
oh,
is.
Oh, anywhere. I mean, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But the Jepson Center in particular in Savannah, because it is in the historic district, it is very attention-getting because, as you said, it is this fantastic glass-enclosed building, contemporary building, plopped down right in the historic district. And I was not here when it was built 10 years ago, but I understand that it was controversial at the time, this idea
oh,
of putting a contemporary building in the space. But, you know, some original designs had talked about creating something that, you know, was like faux old, you know, it was like a modern building, but that would look old and blend in. But the architect that was hired is Moshe Safdie, and his vision was that this needed to be a building of its time. And rather than try to be fake and look old, why, you know, when the Telfair Academy was built, it was a building of its time. You know, it was contemporary. You know, when the Owens Thomas was built and it had the first indoor plumbing, that was as contemporary and cutting edge as you could get. And so why not keep that same spirit alive here in the Jepson Center and build a building that is going to stand for what a museum needs to be in the 21st century, which is open and accessible and lively and vibrant. And so by putting the front wall all of glass where you can stand on the sidewalk and see in, you know, to him, that was very much a metaphor for it, the inclusiveness that needed to be signaled for this new space.
We have run out of time, Lisa. I have so enjoyed this conversation. Lisa, much more continued success, and for the work you do, we need the Lisa Groves of the world. And how nice for you that it's also a labor of love.
Well, it really is. And it's been a joy to be here. I consider it a privilege to be able to work around artists every day. And I do encourage everyone to come visit us and visit museums everywhere your listeners are, because, you know, museums matter and they're an important part of local communities. And, you know, we care a lot and we want more and more people to enjoy what we do.
Great way to end. Lisa Grove, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.